The headlines, the European Union expresses concern about Iran's move to enrich uranium to higher levels and calls on Tehran to reverse the decision. A rights group denounces Israel as an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. And scientists at the World Health Organization warn that mass vaccinations will not bring about herd immunity to the coronavirus this year. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the European Union has called on Iran to reverse its decision to enrich uranium at higher levels. In a statement, the EU asked Tehran to give diplomacy another chance. The bloc said uranium enrichment to up to 20% is very serious development and a matter of deep concern. Last week, Iran began the process of producing 20% uranium enrichment at its Fordow nuclear facility. The move came in line with a recent anti-sanctions bill approved by the parliament. Iran also warned that it will abandon the additional protocol to the non-proliferation treaty if the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal do not fully comply with their obligations. Iran's defense minister says the enemy has failed to achieve its goals by assassinating top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Brigadier General Amir Hatami said there has been no pause or interruption in Fakhrizadeh's work after his death. Hatami said Iranian scientists are continuing his path more determined than ever. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a terrorist attack near Tehran on November 27th. He was the deputy defense minister and the head of Iran's Organization of Defensive Innovative and Research. Iran says there are serious indications of Israel's role in the assassination. An Israeli rights group says Israel is an apartheid regime that enforces Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. Betzalam says Israel has created a system over all the territory in which Jewish citizens have full rights. That's why the rights group says Palestinians are divided into tiers with various levels of rights, but always below Jewish people. Betzalam says Israel has effective control on the Gaza Strip, which the regime blockades. And in the West Bank, Palestinians live in disconnected enclaves under rigid military rule and without political rights. B'Tselem is a non-profit organization that documents human rights violations in the Israeli-occupied territories. Mona Kandil says Israel treats Palestinians as if they are the minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
It's the first time that B'Tselem is accusing Israel of apartheid. The report issued by B'Tselem saying that what Israel is doing on ground, it's not democracy and occupation, as it claims that the Israeli authorities occupy the West Bank, besiege the Gaza Strip, and a part of Jerusalem. Al-Quds, on ground, what's going on is apartheid between river and the sea, because at the time the Israelis are occupying the West Bank. We are speaking about, let's say, 62% of the West Bank, where settlements are being built on private Palestinian lands and on mountains, on hills. Jews are living there. They are having their full rights. Everything they want, they receive. At the same time, Palestinians, who are the real owners of the land, they are not receiving their rights. They are being arrested, shot, killed. Every day, Israeli forces storm the Palestinian lands in the occupied West Bank and arrest people. They confiscate their lands in order to annex it to the settlement. So they continue to treat the Palestinians as they are minority and that they are not the real owners of the land.
Yemen's health ministry has confirmed the continued deterioration of the country's health sector in 2021. The ongoing Saudi-led blockade, the oil derivatives crisis, and the closure of most health sectors have been named as the main contributing factors. Our correspondent in San Abdulatif Al-Washani has more.
2021 will not be any better than the previous years for the health sector in Yemen. This was confirmed by Health Minister Taha al-Mutawakkil in a press conference in the capital Sana'a in response to questions regarding the future of the health situation in Yemen amid the war.
The suffering we are facing today is immense. The needs of the Yemeni people are huge and the infrastructure is poor. Then comes the aggression and the unjust blockade on Yemen, which contributed to the partial or total destruction of medical facilities. More than 315 medical facilities were destroyed by the aggression, including medical centers where international organizations were working. Medicines and medical equipment were also banned from entering the country.
The health minister expects 90% of medical equipment to be out of service in the upcoming weeks due to the end of their lifespan, the continuation of the blockade, and the oil derivatives crisis that has affected the power generation.
The international support provided to the Yemenis health sector can only account for a maximum of 20% of the shortages in light of the spreading disease and the growing number of malnourished patients. All these are the result of the war and the siege imposed on Yemenis.
The health sector in Yemen has faced a tragic situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, during which tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children, were killed and millions of families were displaced. Continued silence is still the position of the United Nations and international community towards the suffering of the people of Yemen, while the Saudi-led blockade has deprived them of most of their basic needs in life.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the United States as the country has reported more than 22,000 fatalities for the second consecutive week. Data suggests that on average, the virus claimed over 3,200 lives per day in the world's worst-hit country last week. New confirmed cases also hit a weekly high there. Cumulatively, over 375,000 Americans have lost their lives and more than 22.5 million others have tested positive since the outbreak of COVID-19. The vaccine rollout that began in the country last month has also hit snag amid reports of slow vaccinations. Less than a third of about 25.5 million doses distributed could be administered so far. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization warned that herd immunity would not be achieved this year despite coronavirus vaccines.
Even as vaccines start protecting the most vulnerable, we're not going to achieve any levels of population immunity or herd immunity in 2021. And even if it happens in a couple of pockets in a few countries, it's not going to protect people across the world.
The chief WHO scientists urged the need to continue taking public health and social measures aimed at halting transmission for the rest of this year. Meanwhile, Brazil, which is the world's second worst-hit country, in terms of deaths, reported nearly 500 new fatalities, taking the tally to over 203,000. New cases there also rose by nearly 26,000 to more than 8.1 million. American and Brazilian presidents have faced harsh criticism for their lackluster response to the pandemic. Japan says it's isolating and analyzing a new strain of the coronavirus that was detected there over the weekend. The new variant was detected in four passengers who had arrived from Brazil. The Japanese health ministry says there is yet no evidence to show whether the new strain is more dangerous or transmissible, but it says the new variant holds similarities to those recently discovered in the UK and South Africa. The detection comes amid Japan's struggle to contain the pandemic. The country has declared a state of emergency in several Western regions to battle the virus. Albert Siegel in Tokyo says Japan is focusing on balancing its economy despite possible dangers from the newly detected COVID variant there.
That strain that came from Brazil that seems to be a little unique, that's one thing, but they just detected yesterday the UK strain did make it into Japan. Apparently there was this individual that came to Japan from the UK that broke his quarantine requirements and held a dinner party with 10 people, infecting half of them. It's not known if it's infected beyond that, but the UK strain itself is in Japan, though it isn't widespread. There is a state of emergency, but it's not anywhere near as robust as the one from last year. And as such, a lot of businesses and individuals, frankly, are ignoring it. This last week was the first weekend that the state of emergency was in place. People have been going out. The estimate is the people going out is about 3.5 times higher than it was last year. Now, people are indeed concerned, and numbers are rising. Actually, the numbers are much higher now than they were last year, but the state of emergency is quite lower. The problem is that the government is trying very hard to balance the economy with the health measures, but it's just not doing a particularly effective job.
Indonesian authorities have found one of the two black boxes of an airliner that crashed into the sea on Saturday. The authorities said the plane's flight data recorder was found during a search operation off Jakarta port Tuesday. They said it would take 2 to 5 days to read the data on the device. The authorities added that they are optimistic the plane's cockpit voice recorder will also be found soon. Authorities have so far failed to find the cause of the Sriwijaya Air's Boeing 737 crash. Its crew reported no emergency or technical problems. 62 people, including 10 children, were on board the plane when it crashed. Divers have so far found a number of bodies, but only one has been identified. A wave of resignations is sweeping through the U.S. administration following the siege of the Capitol building by pro-Donald Trump protesters. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has said he's stepping down. He's the third cabinet official to quit his job in the aftermath of the attack. That comes amid a growing list of resignations by White House aides. In the meantime, counterterrorism prosecutors have opened probes into Wednesday's storming of the Congress building. The raid claimed at least 6 lives, including 2 police officers. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests on several charges, including domestic terrorism. The FBI has warned of more armed protests and uprising being planned for Washington, D.C., as well as dozens of other U.S. cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Earlier, we discussed the issue in detail with our guests in the Newsery program. Let's take a listen.
The FBI has reportedly warned of armed protests being planned for Washington, D.C. and 50 U.S. capital cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Reports say an identified armed group has said it plans to travel to Washington on January the 16th. The group has reportedly pledged an uprising in case of any attempts to strip Trump of his powers. Meanwhile, Washington's mayor has called for increased security around the January 20th inauguration ceremony. She made the call in a letter to the Homeland Security Department, slamming the insurrection on Capitol Hill as an unprecedented terrorist attack. The Pentagon has also been asked to review all members who will be part of the security detail for Biden's inauguration. Colin Campbell is our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and Matthew Fogg is a former chief deputy at the U.S. Marshals Service, also joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome. Colin, what's the latest regarding this FBI bulletin?
Well, right now we know that the Washington Monument has been shut down because of credible intelligence that indicates that could have been under threat. Because of what intelligence officials are searching for online through various media, social media channels, they're finding that what happened last week was a coordinated effort to some degree, and that members of law enforcement may have been part of the problem of the mob that marauded through Capitol Hill and, of course, resulted in at least 5 deaths last week. So right now, what police are looking at, what FBI officials are looking at, and other intelligence officials are the way that some of these militiamen or domestic terrorists are organizing through social media online, and they hope to make a presence at the inauguration on that same day to try to disrupt the process. And so they've already made some preemptive moves to try to secure Congress, to secure various landmarks around Washington, D.C., and, of course, trying to quell any of these dissenters, these violent, aggressive dissenters, from disrupting what has been tradition for many, many years, and, of course, to avoid any casualties in what could be another second insurrection in less than a month.
Matthew, welcome back. You've got armed protests potentially in 50 state capitals. I was just asking you, how do you go about policing that, and what's the danger of that spiraling out of control?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is I think there's enough law enforcement people in this country that we can handle these 50 states as far as the capitals are concerned. And these people, you got the National Guard, which each state can call out the National Guard, have them on call. You got state, local, and federal police. So there's enough manpower, I think, that we can deal with this. The problem is we should have been looking at this long time ago. We're reacting now because of what happened at the Capitol. That should have never happened at the Capitol. And again, the investigation is going to show that, as one of your callers just said, I mean, there was a lot of information showing that there were law enforcement people that were on the inside that was involved in that process. It takes me back to a day back in the early 90s when they had these good old boy roundups where racist groups in Tennessee where law enforcement people were a part of it. And the FBI has reported that there are a lot of white wing racist groups that are part of law enforcement. So the problem that I see here is that there's got to be a purging of law enforcement to determine who in law enforcement is insurrectionist or is trying in some ways to change the government or take over the government. So you're going to have a lot of issues coming out of this, but I think there's enough law enforcement people right now, which are National Guard, that they should be able to ward off any type of assault especially on the U.S. Capitol.
But then again, Matthew, as you say, is there a fear that within the law enforcement there are some that are leaning towards being, you know, Trump supporters, and then Trump supporters are the ones who instigated and have been labeled as domestic terrorists, and they still, obviously still pose a risk and a threat.
Well, that's what they're finding out now. Even in some of these photographs of the U.S. Capitol and what went down there, they're finding out that some of the people that were involved were actually off-duty or law enforcement officials. So, again, this is something that the country is now being forced to reckon with. But I think, believe it or not, because of the fact that there was a stand down of at the Capitol, they didn't have nowhere near the numbers of law enforcement people on duty that should have been there, whether it was the National Guard. I understand the mayor had wanted the National Guard there, and they turned that down. So that's all being worked through right now. But right now, you can best believe the National Guard and everybody will be on guard for these buildings when the inauguration especially takes place on the 20th of January. They're going to have a lot of support.
Very quickly, Matthew, if you can, we've got about a minute left. When you hear that an armed group is pledging an uprising in case of any attempts to strip Trump right. of his powers, having seen how hardcore these supporters of Trump are, that's got to be a source of major concern.
Yeah, it is. It's a major concern, and that's why the FBI, and you can best believe the FBI right now is probably generating all their resources, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearm, U.S. Marshals. Everybody's probably generating a lot of resources right now to try to make a determination on who these leaders are, who these people are, if any of them were at the Capitol at the time to try to figure this thing out. Because you're right, there is a lot of, right now, an investigation going on trying to identify these people. At least the FBI has come out and admitted and said they've got incredible information that armed groups are planning this. So it's going to be an arduous task, but I believe they can have enough security on board that if that does happen, they can defend the U.S. Capitol and these other capitals.
Mr. Falk, thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their contribution. I'm afraid that's all we have the time for this edition of the News Review. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and Matthew Falk, the former chief deputy at the U.S. Marshals Service, also joining us from Washington, D.C.
Elsewhere, a group of U.S. House Republicans plan to introduce a censure resolution against President Donald Trump over his supporters' attack on the Capitol last week. Republican Tom Reed says the resolution will be introduced on Tuesday as an alternative to impeachment of Trump. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called a censure measure the abdication of lawmakers' responsibility. The Democratic-led House has given President Trump one last chance on Tuesday to leave office or face an impeachment. The chamber plans to vote as soon as Wednesday on the articles of impeachment if Trump refuses to quit. The U.S. president is accused of inciting violence on the Capitol as he kept refusing to concede defeat in the November presidential election. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
We can also refer to the great achievements in military areas or the great feats in South Pars. In South Pars, our important gas condensate field, certain achievements have been made while we were under sanctions. We could equally cite the great projects carried out to revive Khuzestan and Ilam lands, which are very important projects. I do not know how much work has been done to promote these achievements and how much the people know about them. Great endeavors were made in connection with reviving the lands that needed drainage in Elam and Khuzestan, primarily in Khuzestan and to some extent in Elam. Many lands were revived and utilized again. All these tasks were carried out during the time of sanctions.
Your light and love, policy. Nothing more I'd ever want or need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Other achievements include the projects undertaken by the Ministry of Energy. I have mentioned before that they are important projects which cover areas such as water and electricity. Let us not forget about the projects set up by Ministry of Roads and finally our impressive military products which are really astonishing. They themselves have acknowledged that Iran managed to manufacture such defensive products during the sanctions. In my opinion, one of the achievements that can be included in this list is the practice of separating the economy of the country from oil. This is a very difficult task. I used to speak about it at length for years, but it would not show any signs of progress. But in the present time, it has naturally happened.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you.
What the world saw on Wednesday with pro-Trump mobs storming the U.S. Capitol was the peak of a year of white nationalist and anti-democratic violence across the U.S. Violence that steadily intensified and featured the direct incitements of the U.S. president. Last February, the FBI issued a report to Congress warning that racially and ethnically motivated violent extremists had become the primary source of domestic terrorist threats and killings. In the past couple of years, white supremacist groups have been causing violence and disruption in the U.S. They're often blamed for growing instances of hate crime and aggravated harassment in the country. Many people have linked this type of violence to the inflammatory rhetoric that the U.S. president used in his speeches. In fact, Trump's constant siding with white supremacist groups will often disrupt protests and rallies carrying semi-automatic rifles, alarmed many of an eruption of a possible conflict in the country. And on January 6th, that conflict happened. Trump has been accused of inciting a mob of supporters to stage an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building in Washington. Five people have died, dozens have gotten arrested, and bipartisan is outraged.
It's an extraordinary situation that we've seen in Washington. When you look at the numbers of people who were rioters, who worked their way into the Capitol, this is incredibly dangerous. In fact, we've never really seen anything like this, certainly not in my lifetime. And this isn't just Donald Trump. There were those who supported him, but clearly by the thousands, what we saw were right-wing extremists, we saw racist groups, we saw others who are all part of this rioting process. And when you look at the buildup over the last 4 years, this isn't particularly shocking.
People now believe that Donald Trump and every politician who promoted the falsehood that the November election was stolen bear tremendous responsibility for riling the supporters who disrupted the counting of the Electoral College vote confirmation. After what happened to the U.S. Capitol, many politicians called for Trump's removal from office before Biden's inauguration. They said that Trump's final days as U.S. president pose a grave national security threat and warrant his immediate removal from office. President-elect Joe Biden called Trump the most incompetent president in the history of the U.S.
He's not fit to serve. He's one of the most incompetent presidents in the history of the United States of America.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump a very dangerous person, saying that his removal is an emergency of the highest magnitude.
If the Vice President and the Cabinet do not act, the Congress may be prepared to move forward with impeachment.
Pelosi said that she has instructed the House to move forward with an impeachment motion if Trump does not leave the Oval Office voluntarily.
It's difficult to remove a sitting president. You have the possibility of the 25th Amendment. But the 25th Amendment requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet. And even then, if the president refuses, you then have to take it to Congress. That's hard. There's only a few days left in Trump's presidency. The other option is impeachment. That, too, is politically complicated, and it takes time. And so it's difficult to do it very, very quickly. But I think it highlights something bigger, something more broad. And that's that the fact that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, actually went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The fact that it was the vice president who was working his way around the president, actually excluding the president from the chain of command, is something simply unprecedented. So it really highlights just how dangerous this actually is, and I think the realities of the difficulty of removing a sitting president.
It's not just the Democrats who seek to remove Trump. Republicans are also calling for his impeachment. They say what Trump did on Wednesday can happen any other time. He has already said that he will not attend Joe Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. But there's still a possibility that he can call another 50,000 people to Washington and create another deadly chaos. Many believe that the U.S. president can even do worse and launch nuclear war on his way out of the White House. That is why officials are trying to close every possible door to chaos. The U.S. president's prized Twitter account has been permanently suspended, and Facebook and Instagram have banned him indefinitely. In the meantime, Pelosi talked to the head of the U.S. military, seeking available precautions for preventing Trump from initiating military hostilities or accessing the launch codes. But although Trump's political power is draining away, his cult of personality still commands tremendous loyalty among his Make America Great Again fan base. That's the reason behind a recent joint statement from all 10 living former U.S. defense secretaries, in which they warned against the military interfering in a peaceful transfer of power.
When one considers how the United States portrays itself in the media and in folklore, it's easy to be fooled into thinking that the streets are paved with gold and everything is bigger and better in the US. However, recent events have clearly shown that the country is flawed to the core. It's hence why the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has questioned just where this utopian image of the United States has gone, as he stated that today we can see what this big idol has turned into. The leader went on to question the rationale of those who still worship the United States, clearly suggesting that some are blinded by ignorance as they fail to see events unfolding before them in Washington and other major US towns and cities across America. Speaking on the economy, the leader also noted the crippling effect of the COVID-19 pandemic on the United States, with the world's highest death rate and numbers reflecting a huge slump in finances, with many people losing their jobs and businesses collapsing due to a lack of positive action by the US government. But the most valid point of all was the leader's analysis on the recent election that took place in the US, not focusing on the result, but on the process and aftermath, with the leader labelling the whole election as a fiasco, sparked of course by the outrageous actions by the outgoing president Donald Trump for inciting violence. In truth, Ayatollah Khamenei had been quoting similar views long before the arrival of the COVID-19 virus, the collapse of the US economy, and of course the disgusting behaviour demonstrated by Trump and his droogs. So did the leader have a point when he delivered his observations this time round?
He does have a point, because I think what people aren't recognizing when they see the US from the outside is that it's going through a fundamental decline. That's hard to believe, and the decline is often not easily, if you like, recognizable. But let me just give you a few indicators. Since 2008, the United States has gone into a 200% increase, a surge in its national debt. $27 trillion is the current United States debt. That's, you know, 200% increase, as I say, over the last 10 or so years.
With the imminent departure of Donald Trump, the arrival of a new US president has left some people feeling optimistic of change, both in America and around the world. Many have questioned the notion of the US and Iran reconciling sometime in the near future under the presidency of Joe Biden. However, with the leader stating that some feel if this happens, Iran will become a paradise, will a relationship with the Americans genuinely benefit Iran?
Well, I think that, Ayatollah Khamenei points to this idea of people who may think that a deal with America will in some way give economic benefits to Iran overnight. This is not going to be the case. You know, the deals that the Iranians will have to do in order to really stand any chance of any kind of collaboration from America are going to be morally impossible for Iran to go ahead with.
But the truth of the matter is, Iran's in no rush to reach out the hand of friendship to the US, with the Americans imposing sanctions on Iran, as well as assassinating Iran's chief counterterrorism commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. It's also why Iran are not waiting for a knock on the door from America to rejoin the JCPOA. With Iran proving itself to be a successfully self-sufficient nation, as well as showing the world that it was and still is more than able to stand up and defeat the American maximum pressure policy, it's no wonder that Iran can stand tall, proud, and confident in its rhetoric. With an abundance of natural resources, four seasons that gift Iran with a fertile and beautiful land, and of course a culture spanning back 5,000 years, it seems that Iran has a lot to be proud of and is already a slice of paradise.
The United States is still reeling from what happened at the heart of the American democracy in the capital of the nation on Wednesday. The unprecedented chaos in Washington, D.C. has been described by many as a shattering blow to the image of America. The extent of polarization of the American society was on full display on Wednesday. Supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump, encouraged by him, marched to the Capitol building as the Congress was meeting to confirm Joe Biden's election victory. Chaotic scenes erupted as Trump supporters clashed with security forces and stormed the Capitol building. The violent mayhem temporarily blocked the counting of the Electoral College votes. Several people lost their lives inside and outside the Congress building. Trump, who has repeated claims of a stolen election, was widely condemned for inciting violence in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday.
What led to this one has been, in terms of its most recent context, 4 years of Donald Trump. And Donald Trump lying to the American people about a number of things, but most recently lying to the American people about the election and the fact that that he won in his mind.
The storming of the Capitol building triggered a number of resignations from Trump's team less than 2 weeks before the outgoing president's term will be over. Meanwhile, senior Democrats are calling for Trump to be removed immediately. They want him to be forced out of office now, either under the disability clause of the 25th Amendment or through an impeachment. 4 years of Trump's divisive presidency seems to have fueled different divisions in the American society to an unprecedented level. The unprecedented violence in Washington, D.C. will undoubtedly be hard for America to recover from. Soon after the storming of the Capitol building by his supporters, Trump committed to an orderly transition of power later this month. But the damage is done. The bitter developments of this week seem to have hugely dented the credibility of America's democracy. Meanwhile, Wednesday's events in Washington drew reactions from around the world. Some countries went so far as to say that the chaos exposed internal collapse in the American political system and that the events showed Western democracy is fragile and broken.
America has been championing this fraud that America is the, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill, and we profess to be the bastion of democracy, but the best way that America seems to be able to bring democracy to other places is at the barrel of a gun. And so what I honestly believe that this has done is it has exposed the hypocrisy of America.
American officials have long lectured the leaders of other countries on democratic values and peaceful transfer of power from one elected president to another. Americans have been very proud of peaceful and smooth handover of government every 4 years, but that did not happen this time. Some observers believe the post-election chaos in the United States shows a growing lack of trust in the system and elections. One recent opinion poll shows more than half of Republican voters believe Trump rightfully won the election. That's tens of millions of Americans that don't trust the election result. The incoming administration of Joe Biden will face many domestic and foreign challenges. But right now, perhaps leading a divided America will probably be the toughest task facing the future president of the United States.
Defend the Constitution.
Saudi Arabia, in a U-turn on its diplomatic course, has decided to lift its land, air, and sea blockade on Qatar following more than 3 years of a standoff between the two countries. The decision was announced at a Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit held in the Saudi city of Al Ula. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman said the kingdom signed a rapprochement agreement with Qatar along with Oman and Kuwait. The prince, a de facto ruler, hailed the agreement, saying the attending nations reaffirmed their Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability. He also thanked the United States and Kuwait for their mediation. The deal, however, seems to be pursuing nothing but an anti-Iran policy by Riyadh. During the summit, MBS repeated the kingdom's anti-Tehran rhetoric, saying there was a desperate need to unite their efforts to what he called develop the West Asia region and confront challenges, especially those posed by Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile program. The Saudi-Qatar rapprochement comes more than 3 years after Riyadh, along with its regional hawks, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt, cut their diplomatic and economic ties with Doha. They sealed their borders and expelled Qatari citizens from their countries. They accused Doha of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. Qatar, however, strongly rejected those allegations, arguing that it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for reconciliation. Qatar, however, did not publicly bow to any of their demands. But what has really caused the Saudi regime to lift this blockade on Qatar and resettle relations with Doha at a time when U.S. President Donald Trump, one of Saudi's main backers in the international coalition against Iran, is leaving office within weeks?
At this point, the Saudi Arabian government knows that Trump is leaving office shortly, and the Biden administration will not be quite as sympathetic to its rogue activities as the Trump administration has been. So for this reason, Saudi Arabia wants to reestablish or at least normalize its ties with Qatar, and that's the reason for them doing this at this time.
While the reconciliation agreement between Saudi Arabia and Qatar is still preliminary in nature, questions arise as to why Riyadh makes a sudden U-turn in its approach toward Doha. Observers say Saudi Arabia is pursuing its own interests.
Saudi Arabia is certainly pursuing its own interests. It isn't acting in the interests of that region of the world or of Qatar, but it does see that the end of the U.S. government's permission to do whatever it chooses is in sight. Also, the Saudi Arabian government realizes that this blockade has not been effective. Qatar has not given in to any of the 13 demands that Saudi Arabia issued when it started this in 2017. So it's been a complete failure. So in order to save face, perhaps, and also to perhaps curry favor with the Biden administration, it is at this time reestablishing these relations with Qatar.
The latest Saudi posture comes in the backdrop of its growing nexus with the Israeli regime. It is no more a secret that the kingdom is seeking to normalize relations with Israel. That came into the spotlight, especially after Donald Trump's senior advisor Jared Kushner said a normalization agreement between Riyadh and Tel Aviv was very imminent. Even the recent U.S. brokered normalization between some Arab countries, namely the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco with Israel, could not have been possible without the Saudi blessing. All in all, what looks to be true is the fact that Saudi Arabia is seeking to establish an anti-Iran front to stand against the Iranian influence in the region.
Because of the recent Arab countries that have established ties with Israel, Saudi Arabia would like to see Qatar join them and then have a more unified front against Iran. However, these nations aren't as willing to demonize Iran as Saudi Arabia is and as the United States is. They see, and Qatar would see, any affiliation with Israel as unrelated to its alliance with Iran.
Riyadh has long accused the Islamic Republic of seeking to destabilize the region. But one may question, isn't it Riyadh that has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions? From maintaining its interference in Libya and Bahrain, Riyadh has also imposed a full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen, killing and maiming tens of thousands of civilians over the past 6 years. What one may also question is how far the Saudi regime seeking to expose its hegemonic agenda in West Asia and beyond.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
This type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zaid As-Salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-Tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio and your program For Humanity, where we are discussing Imam Ali al-Sajjad's Risalatul Huquq, the Treatise of Rights. And we are up to right number 37, where we have been giving an introduction to the rights of your associates. Just imagine how our society would be if we were more cautious about who it is that we mix around with, especially for the younger generation, the youth, who might not see the cruel side of certain individuals. Young adults and teenagers, in most cases, are very, very innocent and sometimes simple and gullible, and might not see or even be able to fathom how evil certain individuals can become. You don't want to go down the dark paths. You don't want to be mixed up in the wrong crowd, as they always say, you know. And parents always point this out, you know, who are you hanging around with? Who is your friend? Don't mix with this person. Stay away from that person. Avoid this individual, you know, because you pick up on things very, very easily. And that's why one element of correct upbringing is you being cautious about who it is that you mix with, making someone bad good, or making someone good bad. Someone might push you to something good, and someone might push you towards something bad. And that's why when you do want to associate with someone, you need to also be observant of their rights as well. Don't deceive them. Don't trick them. That's what Imam Sajjad says. فَلَا فَأَنْ لَا تَغُرَّهُ وَلَا تَغُشَّهُ. Deception is very, very evil and bad. And, you know, you might feel that you are able to cover up certain things, and they might be vulnerable, and you feed off of that vulnerability, and that is the worst thing that any individual can do. And so this is why when it comes to someone who pushes you to good or someone who pushes you to bad, the emphasis here is that very surrounding that you are in. When Imam As-Sajjad, peace be upon him, he says, وَلَا تُكَذِّبْهُ, or وَلَا تُكْذِبْهُ. And this can be read in two ways, where you can say, don't lie to them, and you can also say, don't accuse them of lying as well. As the hadith says, Al-Kidbu Miftahul Shar, that lying is the key to all evil. Another hadith says that if all of evil was placed in one room, was stored in one room, the key to that is lying. When we emphasize on such a thing with mixing and being cautious of who you mix with, this is a very reason why, because you easily pick up on habits. We mentioned habits and we said that, you know, something might be innocently adopted within your habits and then that becomes an addiction. And we know that there are certain individuals who are compulsive liars. You're not even able to tell who is telling the truth and what truth is there in what it is that they are saying. We're going to go for a short break and we will be back soon.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back again, and we've been reading some hadiths from our Prophet and our Imams, and we can also see that in books of akhlaq, in books of morals and mannerism and correct social conduct, we can see that there is an extra emphasis by our ulama on who it is that we guide or who we are guided by. And we always need to look at that in the positive way, where we understand that there is a responsibility that we carry, that we don't just mix with every crowd and we say, well, nice to meet you and my name is this, and then all of a sudden you become very close friends and things like that. No, here at this moment we're not talking about your sadiq, your friend. We're talking about people who you mix with, your that environment that you are surrounding yourself with, because you need to make sure that there is good conduct from your side. You guide the associates, you be nice to them, you invite them to righteous things, and you never deceive them, you never trick them, you never try in any way to lie to them, or never accuse them of lying to you as well. Because Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, in what we can understand, an associate, right, is someone who you associate with. You know, he could be your classmates, it could be your fellow employee, it could be someone who is an individual who you've just become acquainted with. And Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, he says, whoever you are associating with, they have rights over you and you have rights over them. Don't cheat them. Avoid any kind of trickery. And you should never, ever in any way lie to them. Now, there are many verses in the Holy Quran and traditions that speak about companionship as well. Your sahib, your sadiq, and these are just a few pointers that Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, is referring to. Look at what Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi has mentioned. Look at what our Imams have spoken about. So when he says this, that you don't trick them, and you don't you don't cheat with them, and you don't deceive them, and you don't lie to them. And also, another important thing that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is saying is that you don't ignore them. We will speak about this in our next segment. Until then, please visit us on our website, www.parstoday.com, or you're able to email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next program, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
Limit and neutralize Hashd al-Sha'bi's activities with full respect. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy made this decision to get rid of Al-Rapidain Alliance in Iraq. Introduction of Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy is based in Washington, D.C. This institute is a kilometer away from the White House. It is called the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This institute was established in 1985. Its mission statement says that it seeks to advance American interests in West Asia. Who is Martin Indyk? He's Jewish. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was the former research assistant in American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to Israeli regime for two terms, articulated the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq.
Israel is getting the benefit of that growing recognition and acceptance in the Arab world, which started with Egypt and the Israel-Egypt peace treaty and has advanced all of this time in which we've been talking about the travails with the Palestinians, the relations with the Arab states grown and developed.
Martin Indyk is a British-born Jew who is now an American citizen. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy to serve American interests and policies in West Asia. He is the only non-American to have reached the rank of ambassador. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to the Israeli regime for two terms, serving the United States and Israel at the same time. He's a member of the U.S. National Security Council. He received confidence vote from both main U.S. parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. He was also a key member in Camp David Accords. He has dedicated a 40-year effort to paving the way for peace and reconciliation in West Asia, and he makes it as clear as possible that over the past 40 years, he has been absolutely convinced that compromise or peace is possible in West Asia.
For 35 years, I've been essentially devoted my life to trying to achieve a secure peace for Israel.
Martin Indyk introduced the quote-unquote dual containment